I don't know what Ed said there.
He said, I've never seen anything so disgusting in all my life.
I couldn't possibly show it to the lady sitting either side. And, well, I knew that old Jimmy Sullivan, a seaman, had been to his office and had used every vile word that's ever been invented to him. So I didn't think much of that statement. But the boy was placed on probation, as a matter of fact. I happened to be the officer. About 3 days afterwards, one of the lady magistrates came across to the probation office and talked to me about all sorts of things, and then eventually said, oh, but I must tell you that her name was Constance Brown, Brown with an E, the vicar of St. Jude's daughter. She said, was it very dreadful what that boy had written in that letter, Mr. Chesters? I thought, I'm not going to tell you. I said, not really. I don't suppose it really mean anything to him. I've probably seen the word on lavatory walls or something, and just bounced it off. But all that that letter contained was, I think your fucking frocks are frightful.
Is that all?
And that was all it was. That inspector had wasted all those men hours doing this. The court had gathered. All that aggro had been created. The parents had been terribly distressed. He was expelled from Hymas College. He did go to the grammar school afterwards. And all through, well, I think his alliteration was rather marvellous, really. But that is what was happening.
Yeah.
That's what sort of hypocrisy that there was still around in the late 1930s, late 1930s. And these homes that these girls were sent to because they stayed out at night, whether they had sexual intercourse, wasn't really material. These are girls who'd who left school, they were now 15 or 16. And they were sent, if not to an approved school, there were hostels run by the Salvation Army and the Church Army. And they'd be a condition of their probation to reside there for 2 years. And usually was in charge of them, a frustrated old maid who got rid of her inhibitions by, you know, shouting and controlling these girls there. Quite often, the girls also played them up because they thought, we've experienced something you never experienced, and you know, and they were really used to. I mean, they were difficult, but to incarcerate them for all that long time, and then they would send them out as maids to somebody.
Yes.
Now then, what other things do you want to know?
Can I just take you back to Manchester one more time? What I'm not still haven't got clear in my mind is whether how long this training period was for. And whether there was like a Home Office inspection at the end of it. I mean, how did you know you'd sort of passed or whatever?
No. Well, the Home Office had the report, I think, from the principal office at Manchester.
Oh, I see.
You see. And I was already really on. I was really already on their approved candidates list, you see. Had there been any problem, that's where it, you know, how it would have come about, the principal officer. It was for a period of about 12 months.
Yes. The report went to the Home Office.
Well, yes. He was at the CPO, was, mm. in those days. Yeah. I applied to Hull. I didn't particularly want to go there.
You then had to apply for your own job?
Yes, yes. I'd got quite a number of things going, but Hull was the first, and I remember accepting it. Coming back that night that the Edward the Eighth was making his speech, abdicating, and there wasn't a soul about it. Like as though, you know, Manchester had gone dead. Extraordinary. They were all listening. I wasn't at all sure that I was going to go there, but the clerk to the justice, a rather famous chap named Shaw, he said to me, "Well, Harry, you'd do much better to go to a city." I'd got places like Rochdale and different places in my pocket, Northwich in Cheshire. He said, "You go to a city and get some good, you'll get a good experience. Then you can choose almost anywhere after that." And off I went to a city I'd never known before, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. And although the Yorkshire people are a bit slow at accepting you, take the time, when they do once accept you, they're very, very loyal.
Did you stay in the service all through the war?
Yes, you see, I think at 30 you were exempt, you see.
Oh, I see, yes.
Yes.
Can I ask you about, because I became a sort of senior and then PPO.
Yes.
What sort of relationship did the provincial probation service have with the Home Office in London? I mean, did that impinge on you very much? Or were you sort of like laws unto yourself out away from, once you moved right away from London and the Home of Counties? Was it a different world?
No, I'll say I never worked in London. So I mean, I don't know what what it's like working in London under the director. I think, of course, now they've broken that up. I think the probation officers who worked in London always consider themselves a bit superior in that way. But the relationship with the Home Office and the committees. In those days, of course, you had to, when it was made senior, it had to be Home Office approved, and again when I made a PPO, PO. They had that. Now, I think now a senior can be promoted to senior without approval from the Home Office. They kept a fairly tight contact, and they were developing it more then. When I came into the war, the probation service, and they did it mostly through inspectors. If there was something that they wanted to discuss, they would probably invite me to go down and see someone or other. The only trouble was that you never had the same inspector twice, and what one would have a bee in his bonnet about one thing, not about another, and they'd very often give you contradictory advice. So what I found was whatever they said or what they thought should be different, I thanked them very much for their suggestion and make a note of it there. And usually, if it was something that I thought was useful, going to be good, I acted on it. If it wasn't, it went in the waste paper basket, because the next inspector would not be bothered about those things at all. And
it'd probably be harder to get away with that in London, I would think, wouldn't it? Under their noses the whole time.
Well, I don't quite. They had quite know how they did the London, how they controlled it. It was different. And yet, much the same, that they worked on the same rules and those kind of things.
Yes. So, what do you sort of think is the biggest change you've seen in probation or social work in general during the period, say, during the period 1929-1959?
During that time, I was going to say the biggest change is taking the juveniles away from the from the probation officer, and also, of course, there's nothing like the amount of matrimonial work done. It used to be. We did more matrimonial work than we did probation work. It was very much a thing that people should live together, whether they liked it or not, was the idea. I remember having quite a set to with a clerk who said that it was a probation officer's duty to reconcile these people where they wanted to be reconciled or not, because the magistrates had said so. Yeah. They'd adjourned it for you to obtain a reconciliation. And I wouldn't accept it that they'd just see the possibility of a reconciliation. Well, they didn't say possibility. And you should. Well, what he did, he didn't want he just wanted it out of the way so he wouldn't have to waste time hearing it in court. That's really what it was. But it was also. And I had a theory that the magistrates who were most unhappy in the marriage were the ones that always insisted in trying to get people to go, like, I've got to suffer, why shouldn't you?
Yes.
Oh, there we are. You say from up to 1959,
yes.
The biggest change. Oh gosh, all those years back. Biggest change. Well, I think we did become much more conscious of being a profession and getting professional training. And that was the. And the importance of professional training. There was only Rainer House.
Yes.
Doing anything about it, and they worked in judge with the London School of Economics. There were just one or two courses going on degree. I can't remember very much about it. You were too busy chasing around after some body you got to report to the magistrates.
You get the applied social studies starting, don't you, and those probation officers being trained in the university.
Yes, it weren't called applied social studies.
The generic course.
No, they called it social science certificate.
Well, that was before the social science. Social science certificate had been going since the turn of the century, haven't they? But
yes.
Eileen Younghusband.
Yes, well, now
that course started at LSE in 1954.
That's right. It was not until the end. That's right. That was coming. That came later. Yes. Yes, that was the yes. Well, that's it. We were becoming more professionally conscious, and there was real efforts made. And other services were also now into thinking in terms of academic training.
Was it difficult to absorb students from those courses afterwards into the service? I know you're saying something about absorbing people from Rainer House in the 30s who'd been exposed to Emmanuel Miller and
yes, well,
Kate Friedland.
Well, that was the late 30s. To about the 40s. Well, I mean, they came back there from those courses, but again, after a little while, and they sorted themselves out and
yes.
got back to reality. there. But it, matter of fact, it disturbed quite a lot of them. They were their own problems, you see. You can't do it. And it should be set against other theories. That was so, and. Oh dear, they got themselves all churned up inside, these chaps. And it was difficult getting them settled down, after it. Well, then, of course, there was a change at the Home Office. Miss Fandy, who'd been responsible for training, came on to the inspection again, and they got May Irving. And she was very good. Matter of fact, I got May Irving spotted before them. She was at Manchester on the psychiatric social worker course, and I got her to run us a course here. To come, she came down on a Friday afternoon. Every Friday afternoon, before she went to the Home Office, she used this in her application. As a matter of fact. It was a very good course. I used to meet at the Federation House, the pottery industry's house, placed next to the station, so that you could come right from the train from Manchester and come right into the, and we could get going. Success? Oh God, I haven't a clue. I'm not good in checking up on the years. And I hadn't anything to look back.
Exactly. 40s, 50s?
I know. It'd be in the 50s. It would be when the change came at the Home Office. Well, then, of course, she went there, and the whole setup then was casework orientated. The Home Office had been doing a bit. They'd been using these people, would have seminars and things with the American. People and Canadian, I remember Canadian woman. McCrae was the chief, and he was.
McCrae was the.
Principal inspector, the Home Office, and he was moving towards this casework orientation. And it was quite very acceptable to me for it. So, I mean, I devoured it, you know. As I said, you take what you want to take, what you very much so. And so we had May Irving here, and then we had a NAPO meeting and a speaker. I got her one. Oh, we had a weekend school, and I got her there. And then she went to the Home Office, and that was they dropped this Freudian stuff.
Can I ask you my two last
questions?
Okay, so some rather critical things have been said about social work and social workers in this period. I'm thinking of people like Barbara Wootton, the things that she said.
Yes.
But I wonder what you'd say about it all.
Well, Barbara Wootton said what need to be said at that time. It was then that we'd been having the all this Freudian stuff, and there was they were building up psychological jargon to get away with things, and she really threw it all back to us, if you remember. What was the book called?
Social Science and Social Pathology.
Yes, that's it. That was the one. And I've heard her speak twice. Once when I was at Oxford, we were on a conference, and she stayed on, and I was chatting with her. I had a great regard for her. She was a realist. And we got her to come to Stoke. And then I was talking to her then. I was on the committee of this organization, and we had dinner before the meeting. I was there. And then she came to Kiel. And after there I went in and had a chat with her again. And she was my pin-up girl type of thing. She was fearless in what she'd say. She'd had the courage to say things that needed to be said,
yes.
that people ran away from.
Yes.
And she really brought them down to earth. At that time, she was right. It wasn't that. They were building up jargon and theory. But it's awfully difficult to remember. I had the book, but I haven't got it now. Just how she'd put it. But it wasn't that she was against social work as such, but it was this remote sort of stuff, psychoanalytical stuff, she was really saying people what they wanted. They want support and some concern. And that's where it ends. You don't have to go into deep analysis. Oh, it was used to be terrible. You should try and taking them back to when they were children and finding out what their feelings were about this and about the other. And, oh dear. And they, even the clients were sometimes, I don't know who's mad, whether it's me or him. And they talked, a lot of nonsense. I remember one lad where he locked the door before they, now you see, you can say to me anything, you feel secure. That was why he was locking the door. The kid was scared to death.
This terrible last question.
Yes.
What do you think is the best social work thing you've done, looking back on your career? It can be anything.
Social work that I've done, just trying to quite know what you mean.
Well, I purposely left it vague.
So yes. Do you mean with a case? Or,
if you like. Yes.
No, and the one thing that I did, I encouraged the committee. Matter of fact, I had a very good committee, and here I must say that. And I chose young fellows who had good training and good intelligence, with very little experience, because I thought you can always give them the experience, but if they're pretty thick and dull to begin with, I doubt if you can ever really change it. They'll always be thick and dull. And so even the Home Office had jokes about my appointment of these young folks straight from college. But I must say it's worked very, very well. I made an assessment there, but I would prefer to start off with a youngster who had ability and to give him the experience and the opportunities rather than take a chap who probably had been doing good work somewhere or other and work there and then done the Rainer House course or something like that, or come in as a direct entrant. You see, we never had enough trained people. It was very difficult to get a hold of trained people, and you couldn't keep the courts empty, and you very often had to make a direct appointment. It was very to keep up the standard. But I think that That contributed quite a lot to the success of the Stoke service. I'm trying to think what. I can't know that I had anything very successful. Probably wasn't a success.
Yeah, come on.
Trying to always build up a good rapport with the magistrates and the. And the probation officers. I tell you what, it was a great experience for me. I learnt a lot and got a terrific support. Was when we had Eric Sack, was the recorder for Stoke-on-Trent. He was appointed about the same time as I was here. And he was here for 10 years. And then he became a judge of the High Court. Mm. You ever heard the name?
Eric? S-A-C-H or S-A-C-K?
Yes.
S-A-C-H?
Yes.
It's vaguely familiar.
Yes, yes. He's just died, as a matter of fact. Mm. I built up a rapport with him. I got him so interested that I sent him every quarter, I sent him a summary of all the cases he placed on probation and their progress. Put him had a Kalamazoo binder, and he used to read them, and it was very good for the probation officer. He'd put good work. This tell this man that something or other. You see the all little notes on the side of it, and he'd and. Well, I remember almost the first thing that happened. We'd a man before the court, and then who had ill health and living in terrible accommodation with a family. And that was before the court. And the recorder said, asked if we would try and get the local authority to rehouse him. Mm. And the probation officer wrote to the housing and had a very bad letter back from them, in which they said, we don't give corporation houses to jailbirds. Mm-hmm. Well, as the man had never been in jail in his life, it was a ridiculous statement or something or other about it. So I went to discuss this with the recorder, and he said, look, yes, you know your mistake here. You started writing letters. He said, when people have committed themselves to paper, they will never go back on it. He said, the way, if you want anything, is to go and see the person, the head of the department. He said, I found this when I was in the war office, he said. If I wanted anything from another department, I would go, he said, and see the person concerned there. If necessary, sit on the side of his desk and talk to him until you got it. Mm-hmm. He said, that's the way things done, not by writing letters. It's in the personal contact. And by Jove, he was right. You could deal with the most awkward situations personally. Mm. And those little things, but that was only one of them. And then, just a little over 12 months ago, I found out that he was living down in Sussex, Wadhurst, and I was visiting my nephew at the time, who lived down there, and I rang him up. Well, it was his wife who answered the phone, and she said, of course I know you. And she says, I don't suppose you remember you. Mr. Chess, yes. I'll fetch Eric to the phone. And yes, and will I come round and have coffee with him there and then? And You know, we went and we had a real good old chin wagon there. And it was a very delightful experience. The other very delightful experience I had, and again learnt a lot, was when I was in Leeds. The chairman of the juvenile court was a Dr. MacDonald. And I don't know what there was, but there was something that took over. And he was a wonderful understanding of the delinquents. Boy in the days of the Arthur English padded shoulder sort of comes between two policemen, and the policeman, oh, the terrible things that he's done, and all the great deal of feeling and the pressure there, all down and there. He says, I'm adjourning this case. So next week, when he comes up, there's no special press in, nobody there. There isn't the same prosecuting police fellow. It's all much calmer. And then he sends for the boy. Come right up, he says. He said, you know, John, he said, you're not really very brave, are you? This is really only an act. He said, I understand how you feel, and those, you know, what his troubles were, just those things. Now, you've met the probation officer, aren't you? Haven't you? Yes. And, well, can you accept him as a friend? Somebody will help you. Well, the rest of it, all the things, and all the, you know, and he got really right through to the boy, and very few magistrates, you see, could do. And I learned so much from him.
Yes.
And we were both sort of on the same same lines, and that was very supportive to me. And he gave me a book when I left, and bring about shared experiences, which was very nice. So you learn from people, but they're the kind of people you want to learn from. I mean, we've had some very aggressive judges and all those kind of things, but it was always a great challenge. We had a type. It seemed as though different places. If the juvenile court man was good, the magistrate stipendium would be bad, and it'd be the other way around at the other. You never seem to get all good. But they're a challenge, and I remember the old stipendary. The probation officers nearly went mad. I got a probation from him because he'd always refused to put people on probation because they got away without punishment. I think that is the biggest change, of course, is the use of the probation officer in the adult court. They were beginning more. It really did more use in the high courts. The judges were using probationers, but there was magistrates were frightened to let people off at probation. Oh yes, that. I don't know there was anything else. Can you think of anything you want now?
No.
Well, I'll keep you busy sorting that out. I'm sorry it's so...
Yeah, it's running again.
Yes.
You were talking about Leeds.
No, it was Hull, actually. This would be back, perhaps, about 1936. And there was always a bit of feeling about who should present school reports.
Yes.
And the education sent in their senior, in those days, school attendance officer with the reports. I had done a report on the boy appearing before the court, in which I just stated that I'd interviewed the headmaster, who'd made certain statements to me. And the school superintendent, got up on his feet and said he objected very strongly to Mr. Chester's going to the schools, that anybody approaching the school should do it through them, as the headmasters complained of various people knocking on their doors and the rest of it. I was very indignant. I didn't, the magistrates bounced it along, didn't really, weren't really interested, and I didn't make any reply or say anything then. But the next that afternoon, I went round to his office.
Yes.
And told him that if I'd done something that if I found a status, well, I was very sorry, but my concern was for the boy, and that I'd found the headmaster was only too pleased to discuss the boy boy with me, and I hadn't in any way resented, and all I wanted to do was to cooperate with him to get as full as information as we could about the juvenile to place before the court. He did more or less apologize, smooth it all over, and after that we had quite a good relationship. But the other courts, there was an edginess between the school attendance department and the probation. One of the things that I, when I became senior, the things I did, was to stop probation officers making their reports verbally in court. When I arrived at Stoke, there used to be quite a business of the school attendance superintendent talking to the probation officer, finding something a bit more about the boy, getting on, jumping to his on his feet before the probation officer, so he could put in his information about it. Then there was a refusal of the probation officer to then tell the superintendent or discuss the case with him. And it was there was quite a bit of contention. Well, I insisted on a written report being handed in, and none of this hole in the floor.
Yes,
that was what they liked. There was their glorious hour when they could get standing on the feet addressing magistrates. It did something for their ego, and it wasn't particularly welcomed by the probation officers, having to have it all. But it not only did it stop them from making careless statements in court, but they now had to think about what they said, and also we'd got a record of what was said in court. Don't know whether that's of any interest.
Yes, thank you very much.